This week on Snark Squad Pod, we are joined by Deboki from Okidoki Boki to talk about coming-of-age stories. Welcome back to Snark Squad Pod. I'm Nicole Sweeney.
My name is Marines, and this week we are joined by Deboki.
Hi, I'm Deboki, and you can find me on YouTube at Okidoki Boki, where I talk about books and science.
We've asked Deboki to join us this week to talk about coming-of-age stories. Occasionally on this podcast, we take kind of a break from talking about a specific media thing, and we turn to talking about some sort of trope, or really just trope. I don't know why I said or.
Well, we did like sibling stories. That wasn't really a trope, so I don't know, okay. Thematic things.
So yes, tropes are themes, and today is coming-of-age stories, so I have the, it's my turn, I guess, to give where we would usually do the plot synopsis, but I'm going to define, I guess, a coming-of-age story for you guys. And it is a story that focuses on the main character's growth, usually from childhood to adulthood. That is a coming-of-age story.
So the did you like this is tricky with these trope theme episodes, because like, I don't know, sometimes yes, sometimes no. But we have talked about, you know, quite a few coming of age stories, and whenever it comes up, we usually talk about it in sort of broader terms too, in addition to talking about how it shows up in the specific media that we're discussing. So do you generally tend to like coming of age stories, Deboki?
I think to maybe like avoid the question, I feel like my relationship
I love that.
with coming of age stories has changed over time, as I've started to realize that like I'm almost kind of, I don't know what the right word is, but I'm almost surprised by like how early some people's coming of age is now, when I like look back on the books that I used to read, or like TV or movies I used to watch. Like I made a list of like some books and stuff. Like I was thinking of like Sailor Moon, Harry Potter, like these super early formative books for me. And like at the time, I think when I read them, I was like, oh yeah, cool. Like, this makes sense. Like, we're all figuring ourselves out. But I felt like I got to the end of like Harry Potter and Sailor Moon, and they seemed to kind of have it like mostly figured out, like they'd done stuff. And by the time I was like 17 or 18, I didn't feel like I'd done anything. And like now, like a decade later, I'm only just starting to feel like I'm doing stuff. And so I feel like the thing I was thinking about when I was like thinking about this trope for this podcast is just like, I feel like my coming of age has been happening now. And I think of that as, and that's, I think, sort of like an ongoing conversation, maybe something, I don't know if you guys feel similarly, but like that like is sort of part of the whole millennial conversation.
Yeah.
Not to make it about that, but I do feel like it's a part of that. It's like, I feel like now I'm coming of age, and that's very different from what I expected from all like all the media I consumed when I was younger.
I had similar thoughts as I was putting myself together, especially because I was like, you know, when I Googled what's the definition of a coming of age story, a lot of it was around that, like going from childhood to adulthood. So it made me really think about like the idea of like capturing coming of age stories in like a single story, when to me it has felt like I've had like multiple comings of age. Like, you know, there have been different like shifts from one stage of my life to another. And but I think that part of the reason that now I am back in this place where I really love and enjoy coming of age stories is because I still see so much to relate to in them. And so it has been a little bit of a swing for me where these were a lot of my formative stories. I stepped away from them for a while for other things and, you know, other themes and motifs that kind of became my favorite. And now there's something about those stories that I'm like, yes, I can relate to you figuring out adulthood. Me too, person.
Same.
Yeah, yes. Big same. So it's like almost like coming back around for me. I generally love coming of age stories. I love the themes that it can explore. And like we've mentioned, you can do it well and you can do it badly. But for the most part, if I hear something is something something about a coming of age story, I'm like, sold. You know, give it to me. I'll watch it. I'll read it. Let's do it.
I'm also super on board for coming of age stories, again, in general, you know, when done well. But I think part of why I am typically bought in is because, like, the whole premise is exploring ideas about identity and, like, who you are. And as Deboki already said, that still feels relevant to me. I recognize that I'm 31 years old and not, you know, 16, like most coming of age story protagonists. But the basic idea of figuring out, like, getting to a really clear place about who you are is something that I feel like I've only fairly recently done. We have recently on the podcast talked about a couple things that felt like, you know, I don't know, millennial adulthood coming of age stories. Unicorn Store and Shrill both come to mind as things that, like, function very much as coming of age stories but have adult protagonists. Like, I think the mental association with coming of age story is that, like, the of age, you know, component of it, that's why it tends to be attached to, like, becoming an adult and, you know, that transition from childhood to adulthood. But I think the broader themes of being at, like, a big crossroads moment in life, like, that is something that happens over and over again. And so I think, I don't know, it gets a little bit muddier in terms of, like, what constitute, what, you know, are other stories still coming of age stories, or, you know, it's just a character at a crossroads at like a later point in their life, you know, I don't know. But all that said, yes, I do generally tend to like coming of age stories. With that in mind, what are some of your favorite coming of age stories?
So my favorite one, this is, like, probably one of my favorite books that I've read in the past few years, is Jane Unlimited by Kristen Kishore, which is a YA novel. And it has this really interesting form to it that, like, kind of resembles a choose your own adventure novel. But, like, if you were watching it to completion, like, you know, I don't know how you guys would choose your own adventure novels. But when I was little, I would always, like, read through all of the endings, or, like, try to skip to all of the endings as soon as I could to figure out what the actual adventure I wanted to choose was. And this book is kind of like that, where you see it starts with this girl, Jane, who's just graduated high school. She's a year out, doesn't really know what she wants to do. Her aunt, who is taking care of her, has passed away. So she's very kind of, like, lost and confused. And she has a super glamorous friend who just shows up and, like, invites her to her family's island, because that's, like, the kind of friend this person is.
Oh, I need a friend like that.
I know.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah, just has an island. And so once she gets there, basically, as the reader, you get to see, like, there's, like, you know, these, like, really mundane choices that she makes that can lead to all these different outcomes. And as the reader, you get to see what each of those different outcomes are. And to me, that's, like, been maybe, like, as a book for where I was, especially at that point in life, like, I was definitely at a crossroads kind of point in my life. Reading that book really kind of encapsulated the way that I felt, where it's like, it feels like coming of age for me felt like there's so many different options. I don't know what's the best one, and I'm never going to know. And in this book, we're experiencing, like, all the different paths this one girl's life could take, but she's ostensibly going to only experience one of them. And we, as the reader, don't necessarily know what that's going to be. And for some reason, that book for me is just really stuck with me as, like, a coming of age, just, like, both in the way that it's written. It's a YA novel about this girl. Like, it has a lot of the, like, kind of familiar YA stuff to it, but also the form of it is just so similar to me of what the panic of, like, you know, coming of age feels like.
What is it called again?
It's called Jane Unlimited by Kristen Kishore.
Favorite ones are really hard for me to kind of think about, because, again, this is a theme and a trope that shows up all over media. And I don't know, man, there's so many that I could choose from. For right now,
I guess, what are your favorite ones at this precise moment? Sunday night.
I'm literally looking at my bookshelves, like, breaking out in a sweat and panicking.
Don't worry, I did that with my Goodreads earlier
today. All the ones that you don't choose are going to be really hurt and offended.
Jump off the shelf. I'm going to pick this one because I've been reading it for over half my life now, and because my experience of reading it has really changed over my life, and that's Jane Eyre. I don't know that I would have thought of it as a coming of age story when I was like first reading it. Like, I was there for the romance and, you know, all the like dark bits of it and that kind of thing. But reading it now and reading it over and over has really brought me over to how great of a protagonist Jane is, and the way that she really finds herself and her voice, and she stands up for herself and what she thinks is right throughout the story. And the romance bit doesn't age well with me, because Mr. Rochester is kind of the worst, and he's doing really questionable things. So that part has always, like, now I'm like always like, oh, you're really aggressive and you're weird, and you know, maybe don't have a human trapped in the attic kind of thing. But Jane continues to like shine as who she is and her story of like, you know, I'm not a bird, I'm not caged, I won't be anybody's, you know, kind of just, she won't sacrifice what she believes in for anybody. So reading it that way has really been great as I've gotten older.
One of the ones that comes to mind for me is Emma by Jane Austen, which is similarly like ostensibly a romance. But the reason that I love that book is that I love the character of Emma, and like I love watching her sort of journey. I also enjoy the like the romance bits of it, or you know, whatever. But like really, it's Emma's story and watching her figure out who she is and like watching her become a better person by the end of the novel than the one that she is at the beginning of it. And for very sort of classic coming of age reasons, though, right? Like the degree to which she is a lesser person at the beginning is because of all the things that she just doesn't know. Like she just does not realize the degree to which she's wrong all the time. And, you know, and like it's the novel is her sort of journey to figuring that out. And I also very much enjoy reading that book more as a coming of age story than as a romance. The other favorite that I obviously have to mention is the His Dark Materials books, which are Lyra and then later Will's journey, not so much into adulthood as from childhood into adolescence. But the other thing that is jumping out at me now as we are making our way through the series again is Mary Malone's story in the His Dark Materials books. We talked about this a little bit on the Subtle Knife episode, and I was thinking about it, Mario, while you were talking more about the like multiple coming of age moments. And I think it comes up more in the last book, which we have not yet covered on the podcast. So I will, like, as spoiler free as possible, I think in the third book, you see like Mary also having a later in life moment of reevaluating her, you know, her place in the world, and which is very much like what a coming of age story is. When we were talking about The Subtle Knife, I was struck by the sense that I, as much as I love Mary as a character, I couldn't imagine being a child and reading it. Like, I feel like maybe children would find her boring. But I, thinking about it in this context of thinking about the story as a coming of age story, it makes more sense to me why Mary is a like major character who we spend quite a bit of time with, because she also goes on a like coming of age journey, just, you know, much later in life than Will or Lyra. And that's really kind of cool and exciting to see.
I think that, you know, we talked about, you know, if a story is truly a coming of age or if it's just a story about a crossroads in your life. And to me, a lot of the, I don't know if this is the correct answer to that question, but noticing that, like, now that we're talking about this, that a lot of the coming of age stories that I appreciate are not so much about like, what will I do next when faced with this decision, but it's answering the question of who do I want to be, or, you know, like what my place is in the world. And I, thinking about Emma and Jane Eyre, you know, both of those are very much stories where they grow and they learn what kinds of people that they want to be. And so if that happens, you know, when you're crossing over into your teenage years, or again, or for the first time when you're in your 20s or your 30s or whatnot. I think it's less about the age than answering that question, who do I want to be? What's my place in the world?
And I think this is why stories like this resonate well beyond, you know, it's being a teenager or whatever, because this question of who am I and who do I want to be is worth asking yourself, you know, repeatedly throughout your life. Like, this is not a one and done kind of question. So I think that's why even as adults, there is a strong appeal to, you know, YA, because so much of YA literature tends to center on that question. You can also, you know, in adult fiction, but it tends to be much more prevalent in YA.
Deboki mentioned right up at the top some of her formative stories that featured coming of age. And I know we've talked a little bit about favorites here, but I kind of want to go back and talk about formative as well, because I think that's always super interesting to hear about what you were reading and watching kind of during that transition period yourself, and what kinds of things have stuck with you, or maybe what hasn't aged as well now that you're looking back on some of those stories.
Yeah, I mean, so for me, like, I think the two biggest ones are probably Sailor Moon and Harry Potter. And I think, I mean, the biggest thing is, like, magic is not real, unfortunately. Like, I'm never going to be, like, changing magically into, like, a sailor costume and, like, defending the world. I'm not going to be, like, going to Hogwarts. Harry Potter was, like, I mean, for, like, everyone in our age group, I feel like was probably such a major, like, back, even if you weren't reading it, was like such a major background force of like culture, that like it's kind of almost overshadowed some of the other things that were also super important. And like when I look back, I didn't watch the Sailor Moon anime. I read the manga because my parents didn't want cable, so I had to rely on my trips to Barnes & Noble. So, but like Sailor Moon, I feel like when I think about it, it was like also super, super formative. I mean, it was this series that was centered around a group of girls who are just friends with each other and like were really nice to each other, super supportive, like had a lot of fun, but also saved the world. Like everything about them was like super, it was just like super up my alley, because it was like Harry Potter's great and all, but like the way that the books are constructed, like there's all, for me at least, as like growing up as a girl, like I felt like that kind of distance between me and Harry, like it's set, like there's like, you know, there's like all these little minute distances, whereas Sailor Moon is almost so fantastical, like, and it's literally like a cartoon that, you know, the distance is almost makes you feel closer to it. Sorry, I'm going, like, I'm getting to the rambling point about Sailor Moon, like psychoanalyzing myself in my relationship to Sailor Moon.
This is why we've brought you here, so.
Thank you all. I think it's just something so fun that it actually probably had just as much as an impact, which is, I think, also why it survived culturally so long for so many girls.
I want to put a pin in this idea of like magic and coming of age, because I had a whole little sidebar in my notes about it. But first, I will mention some of my formative things. And we used to watch the crap out of this movie. And now kind of looking back, I haven't seen it in years, but looking back and like remembering what happened, I don't really know how this shaped me, because it's like dark and sad, but we used to watch My Girl all the time. And it was, she, you know, talks about getting her first period in this movie. Her father works at like in a mortuary or a funeral home. And so there's a lot of like grim death stuff that surrounds her. And then there is a prominent death in the movie. And so her coming of age comes on the back of like this big tragedy. Thinking about it, like we used to cry every time we watched it. And thinking about it now, I'm like, wow, great, you know, early intro to death. But yeah, we loved the crap out of that movie. And I don't know, I just really remember like tying that to a lot of memories of like being with my sisters and watching the movie and talking about like the things that she's going through and discussing the things that she kind of grows up through as well. So a little bit dark there, but we love that movie as kids.
You mentioned this is total sidebar, but My Girl and like her getting her period for the first time. And I went through this phase, like around the time that I got my period, there was like a few years there where any anytime I read any sort of historical fiction, I was like deeply distressed by nobody talking about what they did. I just need a paragraph where like you explain to me what your 18th century period technology was as a 14 year old, you know, who like can run to the drugstore. I need to understand what's going on here. This like truly to the point of distraction while I was reading at that age. So this is my note to people writing like YA historical fiction. These are the questions that teenage girls are actually asking. Okay.
It's so weird that you say that, because like now I'm thinking of the American Girl dolls, which was like another huge formative like coming of age series. And like I learned about periods not from American Girl dolls, but from the American Girl doll company. I don't remember what the name was, but they had like a book that was like about puberty, that was like to teach you about puberty, and I learned about it from like there, but they never actually had it in the actual American Girl doll books,
right? Yes, okay, that's a whole other sidebar. That's not what we're here to discuss.
Wait,
the podcast.
I have another story like this. So my parents let me like wander free in the library. They were very strict with like what we watched and things like that, but for some reason they never really thought that I was just like going around the library and bringing home books, and they had no idea what I was reading. But I like stumbled across Judy Blume books when I was around, like right around the time that I got my first period. And if you've ever read a Judy Blume book, they're like hardcore. She does not shy away from like talking things about this. And I think it was Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, that I read. And it was like eye-opening for me. But she discusses having her period there for the first time. But these books are old enough that they're talking about like the belt system with like pads and things like that. Uh-huh. I was so confused. I was like, I have no idea what any of this is. Little did I know, I was reading something so outdated that I didn't really need to like pay attention to what was happening. But I was like, a belt? Like, I had no clue what was happening. And then several years later, like I read through Judy Blume's book at that time, and then several years later, this would have been like well into my teens, I was like, oh, remember when I loved Judy Blume? And I tried to pick back Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret back up, and I was mortified and also questioned all of my choices that I ever liked that book. Like, I was so, as a teen, I was like, why would I ever read this? Like, the change in my experience just from a couple of years was wild.
I feel the same sort of stress and pressure around like naming what my formative things were that you were describing around picking your favorites. Mm-hmm. It's a similar sense of like, oh man, what were the ones? What were the big ones? I feel like most of the things that I was consuming during, you know, teenage coming of age ish time is like a lot of soapy trash. Mm. I was obsessed with the Gossip Girl books when I was in high school. The OC, not like things that are dubiously useful in answering these questions of who I'm gonna be. Although again, like the hangups that you have being in that moment, the whole book plot line, I don't remember if they did this on the show or not, but in the books, Blair works really hard and never gets what she wants, and Serena does nothing and always gets what she wants. It's like very heavy, very, very heavy in the books. And Blair basically doesn't get into any colleges, and Serena gets into like all of them. And I like, this infuriated me because I read this when I was a senior in high school. Like, I read this like right at that moment in my life. Yeah. And it made me angry in a way that few books had up to that point. Like, I hadn't experienced that kind of rage around a book plot. But yeah, so I don't have good answers for formative things. A lot of trash. I guess that's the answer. That's why I am this way. My coming of age formative media was trash. And now here I am, a 31-year-old trash.
I think there's something to be said, though, about these coming of age stories that focus around like rich kids. Clueless is also on just my list of like fun things that you know, enjoy, a media that I enjoy that is coming of age. But something about like looking into the lives of like the rich and popular kids and being like, they don't know who they are either. Like, I don't know why that speaks to me or us or whatnot. But it definitely is like, I feel like a
they're just like us.
Yeah. Except for with money.
Yeah. So yeah, like fantasy sort of space. Oh, you mentioned Clueless, which yes, is a perfect film, but also this is not like going to be my thing. I'm just going to casually try to mention that as often as possible. Make sure that people know that Clueless is a perfect film. But also Mean Girls came out when I was in high school. And like that, I think is probably, I don't know, that's one of the movies that I think I've watched the most times, just because of it coming out right at that moment in my life when I would just, I don't know, watch a movie over and over and over again. And also, you know, being, I think it came out when I was 16. So, you know, peak that moment.
I mentioned earlier that I was going to put a pin in this, so I'm circling back around. But I guess one of the, like, sub-genres or whatever of, like, coming-of-age stories that I really enjoy are ones that are magical realism or fairy tale. I think that I really enjoy coming-of-age stories when they have that distance. I was the kid that, like, anytime that they... I was not seeking out stuff about, you know, what's happening to me, my changing body, or anytime that they had like talks about peer pressure, it literally like either embarrassed me or made me so angry. Like I hated talking about that stuff. I hated talking about it. Like I didn't want to engage with that kind of like very in your face, like, I don't know, sort of thing. But if you put magic in there, it then creates a distance where you can look on it and then process in a way that to me didn't feel so on the nose. It didn't cause me so much embarrassment. And that is definitely something that has continued like in my adulthood, is that processing stories when there is a little bit of magic or fantasy helps give me that distance where my brain is like, ah, yes, this is not the same as your life. And then at the end, I'm like, but oh, themes. So I love that. I love that a lot. And I guess some of my favorite, or again, going back to favorite, coming of age story is the Fairyland series by Catherine M. Valenti. And it is very much like Harry Potter, that the coming of age happens across the series because the character is aging up as you read about it. So it felt fuller than like a single story where it's like, you know, you get the problem at the beginning and over the course of like an hour and a half movie or one book, like suddenly they have it figured out by the end. It really felt spread out and you invested time in the character of September, who's the lead character there. And the story at the very beginning tells you basically that she enters this fairy land and she is a heartless child, right? She's irascible. She doesn't know what she's getting into. So you see her kind of grow through all of those things, but also own some of them and turn what the story had first flagged as negatives or weak points in her personality and turn those into positives. So it is such a beautiful story and it has one of my favorite protagonists. So definitely highly recommend.
That is a common like sub trope, I guess, within coming of age stories, is this idea of like recognizing that things that either the character or other surrounding characters frame as negatives are also, you know, positive things too, that traits like tend to be not all bad or all good, you know, like there's there's always kind of another half to it where it's useful to you in some way. When you said that, it reminded me of A Wrinkle in Time, which also there's quite a bit of that, I think, in the beginning of A Wrinkle in Time. I like, my memory of that book is very, very hazy now, but Meg and her emotions, you know, that like in the beginning, that is a source of strife for Meg, but you know, that ends up being central to how she wins in the end. To your point though, about stories with a lot of magic in them, the other thing about those stories is that I think they are also more accessible now. You know, like in there's a degree to which it's easier to situate yourself in that world when like the whole world is radically different because magic, instead of just, you know, it's like the world is the same, but like also you're a teenager now. I'm not articulating this well, but when I think about coming of age stories that I would read now, like YA coming of age stories. There is something about magic. I could see how for some people that's an additional layer of distance and therefore like it wouldn't work. But for me, it, I think Deboki said this, but like it ends up making it closer almost because it's so fantastical.
Yeah, I was actually thinking about this in the context of Game of Thrones, because the two coming of age stories, like, well, the first, like the big one for me is like Sansa. Mm-hmm. And then also Arya, but Sansa especially because of like how dynamic, I guess, of a change her story really is like over the course. Mm-hmm. And partially that's just because I'm obsessed with her. Like, yes. I've been like
pro-Sansa
from the beginning. Welcome. Like, Queen in the North. Like, I don't know if you guys are like trying to not spoil, but like that was like the, like whatever else this last season was, like that was like the best.
Yes.
Like that made it almost all worth it, right? sorry, I'm just assuming you guys agree because I will not listen.
Yeah, yeah, no other opinions are allowed on this podcast.
I was very pro Sansa from the beginning because I was like, I feel like she has all this potential. But one of the weird things that her storyline is one of the parts of her storyline that's frustrating is how much of it depends on trauma. And that's mm-hmm. something that I was thinking about in the coming of age trope overall, is to what extent do we like rely on like dead parents, or in Sansa's case like sexual assault, like, or abuse, like, and sexual assault, like lots of this piled on, like, yeah, like I think when I was initially like kind of like looking up like examples or ideas around coming of age for today, like one of the things that I saw was this idea that like coming of age often starts with like in novels and stuff starts with a trauma, and that's something that was really, I don't know, it's kind of, it makes sense in the context of stories. Like, it gives you this, I don't know, precipitating event to start everything from. But it's also such a strange notion, I guess, just in life. Like, yeah. that your coming of age has to come in part, not that it has to come, but that, you know, that trauma will automatically fuel it.
It goes, I was also thinking about kind of when coming of age goes off the rails for me or when it doesn't work. And it's similar for me. I think that something that you see a lot of times in coming of age is this idea of like sexual awakening hand in hand with like coming of age. And that's good. But a lot of times it comes up against some like tropes about around sex that are really weird, like, you know, you're not a virgin anymore, you're a woman, and that kind of thing that is like, why? So yes, I totally get what you mean about like the presence of trauma or like the presence of some of these like sex tropes, like automatically being something that you're like, okay, I generally like this, but you just did a thing I don't like.
Yeah, like you lose your virginity and you have like the epiphanies you need to be an adult now.
If only.
Sorry, that's what books promise me.
I feel very betrayed.
I think the thing about like fantasy worlds and like magic also is that sometimes it can give a face or a shape to things that in real life don't really have a face or a shape. So I'm thinking about like Buffy, and especially those first couple of seasons, high school as hell, and the way that it like made some of the things that Buffy faced like literal monsters to defeat, and how helpful that was in a coming of age story. And you see that a lot of times in like settings, or I think Harry Potter did this a lot, very literally sometimes, about like the things that he was facing, making them either characters or people that embody these things, like whether it's like the mean teacher who's Umbridge, or like the gossip columnist who is a literal fly. So those kinds of things, like giving them a more concrete shape helps you also encounter them. And you know, that kind of idea works for me in a story, especially about coming of age.
I also love that. I think for reasons we've both talked about this, but like anything that has a very strong meta component. And so like that's part of, I mean, that's what Buffy was doing all the time, you know, like the way in which a character who felt, you know, like unseen and invisible, like became literally invisible and stuff like that, you know, like taking these ideas and then, you know, making it like what is the most extreme and in your face way that we can present this idea of some sort of struggle or challenge of being in high school. And, you know, there are many. And which the other thing, too, that I think, even though I'm, you know, describing it as like in your face, I also think the show took all of those high school problems very seriously. Even though it was a show about this girl trying to prevent the literal apocalypse over and over again, it also took the sort of smaller struggles of teenagers very, very seriously. And I think that is also a like a very big hit or miss point. Some of what you guys were saying about trauma stories, you know, sometimes being a place where it doesn't work, part of why it ends up, you know, not being a thing that works is because it's is when it's not treated earnestly and thoughtfully. And, you know, the idea of like, oh, you had sex and now, you know, you understand being an adult. Well, because you're not taking the time to actually interrogate, you know, these questions of like, who am I and what am I going to be, and making, having your character make active choices. And I think that is a big piece of, you know, what makes it work or not work.
I'm also still like thinking about this trauma thing. You said it and I kind of like went somewhere else, but now it's like sitting in my brain. And so I don't know. I think that the trauma thing is difficult because life is difficult. And I think that, you know, there are things that you have to face that are inevitable and that do kind of spur along your growing up. I think maybe the place where a story that deals with trauma that I will appreciate and one that I won't comes in kind of what Nicole is talking about and in that messaging. So I think for Sansa's story, as an example, for a lot of it, I thought that what we were being shown was that Sansa was who she was from the beginning. She was always kind of, you know, raised to be this lady, and she had kind of her ideas of what her place was in the world. And that was challenged by trauma. But at the end of the day, she grew up to be so Sansa still. Like, she still maintained everything that was essential to who she was as a character. Mm-hmm. And that was great. But then in so many words in that last season, there was that bit about like, you know, she basically was like, because of my abusers, I am who I am. And that's not a message that I can get behind. That I thought was completely contrary to what we had been seeing in Sansa's story and said in so many words. I was like, no, that is not a trauma story that I want, is that, you know, because of your abusers, you are who you are. Instead, you know, Sansa was who she was always, and she kind of, you know, survived and she adapted. And that is the story that I wanted.
Yeah. And I think there's something to be said for coming of age novels that are also able to handle like trauma stories really well. Like, the most notable example to me is going to be Speak by Laurie Halse Anderson, which I remember reading that when I was a teenager. And I think that was like maybe also like a formative novel that I don't like fully appreciate even still, like how formative it was, just for like kind of, it was like the first time I had read a book about rape, and the way that it treated that was, I don't know, it was so empathetic and understanding of the main character and the way that it's affecting her and the way that she's acting out. And so I think there's definitely a real place for that in coming age. And then you get to, yeah, that kind of casual sort of line, which Game of Thrones is so, you know, that's been the issue with it for a long time, is, you know, the casual way they treat that sexual violence against women. That's just, it's so frustrating.
I also want to mention, in the way of, you know, stories that handled it well, Exit Pursued by a Bear by E.K. Johnston is also like a, you know, the main character is raped near the beginning of the novel. And like, that is a, you know, sort of formative, like turning point-y moment that brings about the rest of the story, but is also dealt with like very, very thoughtfully. And the people around her believe her. And I think that was probably the biggest thing. It's like, oh, like everyone believes you. Wow. What a rare thing to see. But like, was handled incredibly well.
I will add a recommendation. This isn't about sexual assault, but it is about the death of a parent. And it is A Million Junes by Emily Henry. And it does have magical realism. Heads up. If you haven't picked up on a little pattern for me. But I thought it did such a good job about, in the story, the main character is almost like haunted. She's seeing ghosts, but it is a stand-in for how she feels haunted by her grief and some of what she's going through. And I think it does such a great job of allowing her her space and, like Nicole said, like respecting the feelings and everything that she's going through the trauma. So that is also a great one to pick up.
I have like a weird theory / question / hot take. I'm not really sure. I don't know if it's any of those things. I might be overpromising. But I was thinking about this in the context of trauma and rich kids. So obviously logical conclusions.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
The trauma thing, I feel like it's also connected to like in Disney, you have like the dead parents. Mm-hmm, like mm-hmm. There's like this whole thing about dead parents. I think a thing I've wondered is the extent to which we rely on the absence of parents to enable a coming of age story. And I think I've thought about that because growing up, my parents have been very protective. Like, so when I was reading these books, I was always like, I don't understand how these kids are able to do all this. Like, I'm at home all the time with my parents, or like right. if I'm going yes. out, like, they You're know where I am. I don't understand how these kids do these things. And so like when I was reading Gossip Girl, I was like, oh yeah, you know, they're rich kids. Like, of course that's why they're able to do all this. Like,
money.
So, yeah. So to like what extent do we like rely, I guess, yeah, on the absence of parents to enable a coming of age story?
Oh, I mean, I think like heavily, and it is a thing that I like. I understand why it is a problem for people, but I also fully understand why it is something that, you know, writers telling stories about children will lean on it, because like there is an element to, if you're like having, you know, a 13-year-old as the center of your story, there is often the question, like, where the fuck are your parents? Like, and you know, I don't know, maybe other 13-year-olds won't ask that question because they're happy to just be like, yeah, I'm going on an adventure with this 13-year-old. I don't know. But like, for sure, if you are, especially if you are an adult trying to write a story about this 13-year-old, you as an adult should definitely be thinking, where is this child's parents? And the easiest way to answer that question is to just remove the parents, mm-hmm. eliminate them entirely, and then you've Orphan. Answered the question. Right. No parents, no problem.
Right. I think, and yes, this is something that I have become hyper aware of as I've gotten older and continue to read coming of age stories and YA. We had this whole thing on Buffy about Joyce like never noticing that Buffy was right. like
Joyce
sneaking.
Sucked.
She sucked so bad. But she it was a writing problem. Like she was almost like she was written as if she were a good parent, but she was never actually there, because in order for Buffy to be slaying at night, Joyce had to be not paying attention. So Joyce sucked as a parent because Buffy needed to go on her adventures. But I think that there are ways to do it well. Like, I think that it's not easy. And I think sometimes the shortcut is to say the parents are not there, or magic is another good shortcut. You know, why aren't the parents there? Magic. You know, Coraline goes to a
Meg's
different
in
dimension.
Another dimension.
Right. Another dimension. or that's a good like shortcut there as well. But there are stories like The Hate U Give by Angie Thomas that is about this girl coming of age, and the parents are so present, and it's what makes the story amazing. And, you know, she is experiencing things by herself. She does like a big portion of it is her like at a protest, and her parents are nowhere to be found, but it's in ways that are logical, and you know that the parents are present and care. So it can be done. Often it's mm-hmm. just easier to be like, and this door is a portal. Goodbye, parents.
Bye, parents.
To magical non-parents.
And I mean, it is really tricky. I think part of why like Joyce was so frustrating too is that, as you said, like she was written in other places as being a good parent. And I think, you know, like there's a way that you also have that story, and you know, Buffy just has like a really shitty, you know, negligent parent, and that's how we tell the story, and that's also is fine. It was the constant dance back and forth between like, no, this week Joyce is a good parent. like, never mind the whole like rest of the season where she didn't notice all the blood on her daughter's clothes. Like, whatever. She's a good parent this week because Buffy is going to have some parental intervention as her obstacle this week. But then next week we'll be back to, you know, Joyce being negligent in a way that we're not actually going to acknowledge. to what extent are you grappling honestly with with the relationship between the parents and these characters, whether, you know, whether it is to just, you know, like remove them from the story. And I think in defense of going that route, I also think that another reason for doing it isn't just a question of, you know, it's like it's easier, but it's also the balance in The Hate U Give allowed for the, like, the parents to play as central a role as they did. I think that, you know, like with Harry Potter, there is so much going on in this world that, like, yes, you just stick them in a boarding school and, like, that's, you know, and that's we're not gonna worry about
the liability of that boarding school seems to be
the most dangerous school ever.
Because, like, my high school was a boarding school and, like, I wasn't a boarder, but I felt like I had more freedom compared to a lot of the boarders until reading, like, about Hogwarts. I'm like, guys are gonna get sued.
I just, there, I've, a number of things that we've talked about, I'm honestly not even on the podcast, it's like just Mari and I were having a conversation just recently about, like, but movies that have had kind of too many plot threads, and specifically, like, thinking about movies where, you know, you have 2 hours to tell your story and, like, maybe you can't have 19 plots in 2 hours, but whatever. Just because this particular grievance is fresh on my mind, I am at this precise moment in time more inclined to, I don't know, give a pass to the idea of, like, eliminating the parents from the picture, if for no other reason than, like, streamlining and, like, focusing on the actual story that you want to tell. And like, you know, maybe good parenting isn't part of that story. I don't know.
This reminds me of The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, which is also...
Yes, yes.
Kind of coming... I would call it a coming of age story.
Yeah, totally. It falls into this category of, like, of, you know, this is a person who had a second, like, crossroads and is, yes, like, coming into the world, like, coming of age. She's starting her adulthood over again.
Yeah. When we were talking about that show, we talked a lot about what a bad parent she was, but also that we didn't want to watch her parenting. Like, right. And, like, I don't want to see that story. I'm just acknowledging that there's an absence of it, which is probably, like, if we saw all of these kids grappling with their parents, also we'd be like, boo, move it along.
Right. Yeah, like, why are the parents trying to, like, ruin the story for us?
Your curfew is, like, really getting in the way.
Reasonable, like, they're trying to prevent the apocalypse, they can't tell you about it because they've got superpowers, like, it's a thing.
I'm gonna take the fact that you just said superpowers and tack on this, like, last little thing that I wanted to talk about in terms of coming of age stories. And maybe it's because we've done so many Marvel movies and because I saw Dark Phoenix this weekend, but I was also thinking about how a lot of times origin stories for superheroes are also coming of age stories. And I think Wonder Woman did this in terms of, like, you know, her finding herself and discovering what kind of hero she wanted to be and facing her fears. And Spider-Man is a good example of that. I thought Dark Phoenix, while there is probably a lot to talk about good and bad there, I thought that was an interesting entry into this idea of, like, becoming or finding what kind of hero you want to be. And also Man of Steel, which was a kind of a trash movie, but I thought that the most interesting portion of it was Clark figuring out, like, after, you know, basically going around the world and trying to find a place, figuring out that he could be a hero and what kind of hero he wanted to be. And it is, like, one of my favorite superhero stories to be told, is that exploration of, like, okay, what kind of hero do I want to be?
Because I also saw Dark Phoenix this weekend, I, like, want to circle back to that specifically, because not only is it about her figuring out who she wants to be, it's also goes back to the thing that we've been talking about over and over again, which is, like, this question of who do I want to be is not a one and done question. And so I think another kind of major plot thread in Dark Phoenix is that Professor Xavier is also being forced to, like, re-examine, you know, like, he had answered this question of who he was going to be, and, like, everything surrounding Jean Grey, like, the events of the movie basically force him to re-ask that question. I think the movie didn't quite go as far as I wanted it to in terms of how it had him resolve that, like, issue, but I think this was a persistent question throughout the movie of this idea of like, who do I want to be?
I don't have like anything insightful to add. I was just thinking about this in the context of the parents discussion. And this thing back to coming of age in Marvel and the Runaways, where like they solve the parents' problem by just having them be the bad guys.
Yes.
Like they're still there.
This is my biggest problem with the TV show, though, is that like it is my understanding that the comics makes them more like explicitly bad guys. The TV show keeps trying to make them like, you know, morally gray. And I just, it's like not, it's not working for me. It's not like, just make them, let them be bad guys. Just let the parents be evil. And like, and then your whole story will work better. I don't really know why. I don't know. I guess the why is that you cast, you know, a few well-known actors is why. I'm not, as these parents, I don't know. Going back and forth on the parents being good or bad, being, you know, on the fence. Like really there's just one big bad guy and like it's, he manipulated them into doing bad things. Like, no, just make them evil. Just make them fucking evil. And then their kids, and like then that is a much more, that whole premise of, you know, the kids saying, who do I want to be, the natural answer is not something that has to do with your parents. Right. Like for kids who have good parents, like, you know, your parents have a really strong positive influence on this, the answer to the question of who do I want to be. And so for these kids to have previously viewed their parents at like in that light, to have had a like fairly well-adjusted, I guess, life, and that, you know, believing that their parents are these big time philanthropists and whatever. And then as teenagers to suddenly discover that their parents are actually supervillains. And so like who I want to be is not my fucking supervillain parents. Yeah. That whole idea is really cool and interesting. And I am mostly enjoying the show, but I really wish the show would make the parents evil. Like properly evil. And I'm going to complain about this for as long as the show is on the air.
I think that's fair. I mean, I feel like we've already done like morally gray parents who are just acting in the best interests of their child. Like, just let them go full evil.
Well, on that note of letting the parents go full evil, I guess that brings us.
This isn't coming out on like Father's Day.
Happy Father's Day. Let the parents go full evil. Thank you so much to Topoki for joining us and to all of you for listening. We would love it if you consider joining our community on Patreon at patreon.com/snarksquad, where we have some polls and bonus content and other fun stuff. We would love to hear all of your thoughts on coming of age stories. There will be a post dedicated to this episode up on snarksquad.com, or you can always find us on Twitter at snark_squad. I am at Sweeney Says.
You can find me at My Name is Marines.
And I am at okidoki_boki.
Thank you, as always, to Stefan Chin for the theme music that is playing us out right now. And we will be back in your podcast feed again next week. Bye.